Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is PJ Harlow. I am your host, and you are listening to The Tourist. I am super excited today to introduce you guys to my guest, Beth Lambert. I have been such a fan of hers since devouring her book, A Compromised Generation, which really provided me with the first honest viewpoint of my own collective toxic health, and more so how the environment and toxicity and all of these things epidemically are reaching my children's generation on such a macro level that it's just criminal that nobody's talking about this. Beth is a brilliant woman. She is the founder and executive director of Epidemic Answers, which is a nonprofit foundation that offers a starting point for parents who are looking for answers to understand why their children are chronically ill and what can be done to help recover them. Her website, and along with her partners, they provide a wealth of easy to digest educational resources and networking tools, links to coaching. In this interview, Beth and I cover a lot of territory. Primarily, we talk about children's health and our present statistics that are showing how we as a nation have some real problems. This is a hidden crisis that I've been wanting to shine some light on for quite some time. So I'm really grateful that Beth agreed to do this interview with me. If you're a parent, or you want to be a parent, or you happen to be a human, you need to be listening to this podcast. I don't like to give too much away in these introductions, and I feel like everybody just skips past them anyway. So without further ado, here is my delightful, educational, and essential interview with Beth Lambert. Welcome, Beth. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, PJ. I'm happy to be here.
I know we've been planning this for quite some time. I'm really just grateful for our connection and this opportunity. I really wanted to stay present and illustrate to my listeners the reality that we are in right now. And I share many of the same pursuits as you, Beth. And I think for me, it's been most challenging recently to not only spread awareness, but to have people engage and comprehend the gravity of the issues that we're facing with our children and the rapidly changing environment where that we're in. Additionally, I can't really ignore the societal and political climate that we're in right now, too. Mm-hmm. And lately, I've been really focusing on the real importance of informed choice and how powerful the choices that I make are, and essentially even more so, how those choices affect myself and the people around me now and in the future. Before we kind of go into some of the obstacles that we're facing and these other topics, I feel like we need to go backwards a little bit. So statistically, can you share some truth with regards to how things have changed in the past, you know, few decades? And what are we facing now with the health of our children?
Sure. So I think the most commonly cited statistic you hear out there is this number that 54% of American kids have a diagnosed chronic health condition. And that statistic comes from a research paper that was done in 2011 and published in Academic Pediatrics. And what it looked at is just the sheer number of kids who are diagnosed with obesity, diabetes, ADHD, and they looked at other neurodevelopmental, neurobehavioral disorders like autism. And when you look at the society, our society and the health of our children, it's not good. So if the majority of children have a diagnosed chronic condition, and again, that was a 2011 study, one of the things I always talk about is, well, okay, what does the rest of the population look like? The other 46% of the kids, are they all healthy? And the assumption is, well, if they don't have a diagnosed condition, they're healthy. And actually, I think that's not the case, because if you look at kids that are out there who have, maybe they don't have a diabetes diagnosis, or maybe they don't have an ADHD diagnosis, but they do have something. You know, they have chronic constipation, or they have skin rashes, or behavioral problems, or inability to focus or learn and concentrate. And so if anyone's a parent or is around children as a teacher or a paraprofessional, you are tuned into this major health crisis we're facing with our kids. It's not just 54% of American kids that have a diagnosed chronic condition. It's 54% of American kids that have a diagnosed chronic condition. And then, you know, a good percentage of the rest of the population of kids have something going on. They just might not have a diagnosis. So I think what we're seeing here is one of the most underreported, underrecognized crises of modern times, which is that we are raising an entire generation of children who are not going to be able to think clearly and support themselves, and that are not going to live a productive, vital life, you know, that they should be able to. So, you know, you can dive into any of the diagnostic categories and you're going to see they're all on the same trajectory, and that is upward. So it's a major health crisis. It's not getting the attention it needs. I think we need to start thinking about why we're seeing so many sick kids and what can we do to reverse the trend.
I can't agree with you more. I feel like, and I know I've heard you speak about this, and I completely agree with you. There's like this normalization of being unwell. And I know that even in my own family, I kind of co-signed certain things and made all these different excuses. You know, in our own household, we had gluten intolerance and food allergies and constant ear infections, constant strep, croup. Three of my kids have anxiety issues. We had chronic constipation, bloody noses constantly. And then when I'm told that, oh, that's normal, there's just this global acceptance of what our health is supposed to be. And I don't know where we stopped looking at our own responsibility in that. It took me a while before I really took responsibility of my own health and realized, like, wait a second, this isn't right. This isn't normal. I know that we're probably around the same age. Like, I don't remember this when we were in school. Even though we're being told that this is normal per se, it's absolutely not. Can you kind of bring to light some of those symptoms that parents may not be aware are you're not supposed to have?
Right. And I think you nailed it when you said we've normalized this. This has become our new normal. So one of the things that I think we should be aware of as parents is it starts from the very beginning. You know, when you're around other parents and you're a first-time parent, you have no awareness of what a healthy child looks like versus an unhealthy child. You have no awareness of what is typical. So like, let's imagine you're in a baby play group. You're a new parent. And you're sitting around talking about what it's like to be a new parent and what your infant does. And, you know, every child's on Prilosec or Prevacid. Every child has explosive diarrhea in their diapers. Every child has patches of eczema. So when you're sitting in a group where that's all that is around you, it just feels like normal, you know, and then you go to your pediatrician for help, right? This is one of the factors I think that contributes to the problem of not seeing it, is that, you know, we get that we trust our pediatricians have the best, you know, are looking after our kids, have their best interest at heart. And typically they do, but their training wasn't looking for this kind of thing. And I think when they see a lot of it in their practices, you know, imagine a new physician coming off and seeing the same things over and over again, it feels typical. It feels normal. What we're missing though is that long view, right? Somebody who was a pediatrician in the 60s and still is a pediatrician today, it's going to say, nope, there's something going on here. Something's different. Because you go back to 1960, and you had less than 10% of American kids had some kind of diagnosed chronic condition. It wasn't just about we're better at diagnosing. I mean, that's a part of it. But it's really that there's just more impacted kids. So I think culturally, we rely on our physicians to tell us if something's wrong or scary, but they're not raising the flag. So what we have to do is we have to rely on ourselves as moms to trust that, and dads, to trust that parental instinct to say something isn't right here. I don't think it's normal that my child's covered in eczema. I don't think it's normal that they have sensory issues or chronic constipation or what have you. And then once you, you know, find that instinct, you need to pursue that instinct and say, well, okay, well, if this isn't normal, what is normal? And what should I be doing to help my child? I think because people are so in their day-to-day lives, they're just trying to get through the day that, you know, we just are looking for, you know, whatever band-aid or quick fix we can find to help us manage the symptoms. But we really all need to take a step back, look around and say, okay, all of this stuff that's happening to our kids, not normal. We're accepting it as such because it's common. Common does not mean normal. And that's what we really need to pay attention to is how can we pull ourselves, extract ourselves from this kind of acceptance of, you know, this epidemic?
I like that you really hit some points there that I wanted to kind of come back to. Creating PJ Harlow Wellness and doing all of this advocacy and awareness, I've run into this denial, or even at sometimes it feels like this wall, or there's this just this defensiveness from people. And I've had to really take a look at my own experience, and you kind of talked about this. I spent a majority of my life, you know, doing what I was told by my doctors, and I trusted them implicitly, and I never really looked at the polarity in my actions, and more so how I was made to feel, which was to distrust my own instincts and my own intuitive capabilities. And with everything that happened to my family and how we just continually hit dead ends, and it really kind of made me reevaluate. And I came to this realization of just how disempowered we're made to feel. And I don't always think that it's intentional or anything. It's just kind of like the way things are. And we're sold this ideation that disease and illness and our immunity can be controlled. And it's this illusion of safety and this one-size-fits-all medicalization package. And historically, I feel like people are unaware and we've lost the truth. We've lost centuries of healing modalities and birthing knowledge. Birth is now like a medical process. I'm not downing allopathic medicine in any way or form because I feel like there's a need for everything. You know, I feel like the fact that we're born into a climate that thrives on our fears and our insecurities and then ultimately our dependence. And I think that part really needs to be recognized for what it is. Like health right now, it's a business.
Right.
And we've got this divide where we have people that who are still not seeing that conflict of interest. But on the other hand, I've recently witnessed a paradigm shift where I've seen a lot of women and moms and parents who are just coming up now. And once they're reminded of just how capable they are, they start to see.
Right.
And so I wanted you to kind of help people listening with some of the information that you've been able to consolidate. Like, what kind of signs are awakening parents? And can you illuminate some ways on how this is impacting us economically or even as a society in a whole?
Yeah, I think what you just described is cultural and historical. In other words, we're in this moment right now, and a lot of people are waking up to it, where the pendulum has swung really far from where we have been for thousands of years, right? So for thousands of years, you know, for time immemorial, human beings have lived in rhythm with nature. And within family units, you know, we took care of our own healthcare, or not healthcare, it's not even the word, that's a modern world. We took care of our own health. We lived a life where we took responsibility for that. And now we're in this modern era where things have changed dramatically, both in how we live and how we think and view our health. And I think you're right, there is a business aspect that has changed. But if you go to like the post-World War II era, where we've industrialized a whole lot of things in our world, especially in the developed world, and we developed this new kind of trust in technology, in medical innovation, and in the practice of medicine. I mean, if you think about what antibiotics did for human culture, before the sulfa drugs in the 1930s, you had human beings who are terrified of germs, you know, bacteria that like tuberculosis that could kill you. And then all of a sudden you have the development of antibiotics where somebody who was on their deathbed and was going to die of tuberculosis, they take a little magic pill and then they spring back to health and everything seems to be fine. I mean, that is a profound thing that happened to humanity. And that's just one example of how innovation, technology, and modern medicine have changed our psyche, have culturally shaped us in this modern era. And another example of that would be genetics, right? So we discover, you know, we've mapped the human genome and we're like, wow, this is amazing. Now we understand so much more about human beings and how we are. And so we've begun, because of these innovations and this new learning in science, technology, and medicine, we have begun to doubt our own capacity to understand human health, and we start outsourcing it. So I would say, you know, there's been a major cultural shift where parents in particular, all of us as human beings, are outsourcing our healthcare, outsourcing our health, thinking like, well, if I'm sick, it must be because of my genes. Only the doctors know what to do. I can't possibly understand how to make myself better. And that's just not true. I mean, and so the pendulum swinging back, what we're seeing is that people are waking up to that reality, that cultural shift that happened, that moment we were in, is false. So you have people who are starting to become empowered and see that, okay, genes are not my destiny, that stranglehold of genetic determinism that really ruled for the last couple of decades is beginning to show signs of weakness. Because it's not about just about the genes. Genes don't determine your health. It's genes plus environment, plus in lifestyle, plus mindset. And there's so many factors that actually influence your health. And science is now bearing that out too. There's this whole field of epigenetics, and we've discovered all these things about the microbiome, and our access to information and the internet is bringing that pendulum into the moment of empowerment, as you described. So now people are accessing information. They are accessing the medical journals that were, you know, things only doctors and scientists and researchers had access to. They are realizing that when they make changes in their lifestyle, including diet, getting more exercise, getting outside more, doing things more in sync with nature, when they do those things, they are feeling their health improve. They're seeing those things improve with their children. So I'm very optimistic, despite all of the doom and gloom of the statistics, what's happening to our kids who are the canaries in the coal mine, telling us that the way we're living in the modern world is not sustainable. Despite all of that, I'm very optimistic because I think you're right, PJ, that we are in this moment of empowerment, that parents in particular are waking up to what is just a false health paradigm. And they're starting to see that they can take ownership over their family's health. They can control a lot more than people used to think. So it is a reason to be optimistic, but I think we need to do more to continue to foster people's empowerment and let them know that it's okay for them to take responsibility for their health, and they don't need to outsource it to a medical professional. There's so much we can do to protect our health on our own.
That's one of the things that I really love about Epidemic Answers. You know, your mission is to help empower parents and help empower caregivers and individuals. We have the similar beliefs in approaching health through more natural, holistic, and functional model. Can you get a little bit more detailed and hit on some of the physiological similarities in the conditions that our kids have right now and get more in depth about root causes?
Yeah, sure. And again, that's why I'm so optimistic, is because instead of being locked in this, you know, genetic determinism, this gene-based idea that like, oh, my child has autism, it's genetic and there's therefore nothing we can do, or oh, my child has asthma and it's genetic and there's nothing we can do. That's pretty awful. That's an awful place to be in. It's disempowering. What science has shown us in recent decades is that the child with autism and the child with asthma actually have a lot in common physiologically. So if you peel away the diagnosis and you look at kids who are showing signs and symptoms, whether it's neurobehavioral signs and symptoms, whether it's immune symptoms, skin symptoms, breathing symptoms, GI symptoms, you peel away the diagnosis and you're going to see a lot of things in common. And those things include imbalances in the microbiome. That's a major, major contributor to all of these chronic conditions that are escalating. And there's very easy reasons to explain why that's happening. I mean, you look at the use of antibiotics and proton pump inhibitors and hormone and steroid medications, and the diet we're eating, that all alters the microbiome. And that's important because microbiome plays a vital role in detoxification, immune function. You know, so that's one example of how there's common underlying root causes for different conditions. Another one would be toxicity. We happen to live in a very toxic world. And again, we have really done a number in the last 200 years, but especially in the last 75 years in destroying the planet, just pumping toxins into the air, the water, the soil. I mean, it's really, really difficult to avoid toxic exposures in the modern world. And so if you look across, if you compare kids who have a diagnosis and kids who don't have a diagnosis, another commonality is those kids who have a diagnosis tend to be more toxic, have a greater body burden of toxins. They might have more phthalates or heavy metals in their body. And interestingly enough, if your microbiome is imbalanced, you don't have as strong of a capability to detoxify, to remove those toxins from your body. So again, it doesn't matter if your child has ADHD, or whether your child has type 2 diabetes, you're going to see microbiome imbalances. You're going to see cellular toxicity. You're going to see increased oxidative stress, which is basically just free radicals roaming around in your body doing damage to your cells and tissues. So you can go into any number of physiological things and look at them, and you'll see them common across diagnostic categories. Structural things like airway and breathing issues. That's another very common thing today. That structurally our jaws aren't forming and our cranial structures aren't forming to optimize breathing, nasal breathing. And that has downstream effects. It can contribute to behavioral symptoms. It can contribute to inflammation in the body. So there is an endless list of physiological imbalances that you can find across diagnostic categories. But I think it's so important that we shift our paradigm and start saying, okay, well, instead of saying this child has ADHD or this child has diabetes, we say, what might be contributing to the symptoms that we call ADHD, or what might be contributing to the symptoms that we're calling type 2 diabetes? Look deeper, look on a physiological level, look to see what's out of balance. And that's what you just mentioned, that's what Epidemic Answers tries to do, is help parents start looking for root causes, not get caught up in the diagnostic label and where that box that it puts you in, not to think about genes as destiny. I mean, genes are important. I don't mean to discount the fact that genes do have an importance, but to look beyond that and say, all right, what in my child's environment might be contributing to those physiological imbalances? And what can I do to change that picture? Because that is the most empowering thing ever, is to say, oh my gosh, I can do something about diet. I don't need a miracle pill for this. I can do something about getting my child to sleep earlier. So that's what I like about the work we do through Epidemic Answers, is we want the parents to have the tools to make a difference in their child's life.
And you hit on some things, talking about toxicity. I mean, that is what happened to our family, and a lot of people that we knew really didn't understand what happened to our family as a whole. And I'll ask you in a few minutes here to kind of explain total load to people, because that's exactly what happened to our family. Unbeknownst to us, we had all had underlying Lyme disease and co-infections, but at the time, our immune systems were pretty robust and able to kind of handle it on its own until I actually got my first flu shot, and that triggered something in my system, and I had a really bad reaction to it. And then after that, it was just like my health went downhill. Well, our house was full of toxic mold, Stachybotrys, and we didn't know. We had no idea that it was in our HVAC system, and we were just steady breathing it in. And because our symptoms were just, as I kind of explained previously, they were all just these little things that nothing was so major that it would make it alarming until you combine everything together and really, like you said, look at break it down to the root and figure out, like, why is all of this happening? And then to find out that it was toxicity. And a lot of these things I had never heard of. I had never heard of heavy metal toxicity. I didn't know that the amalgams in my mouth could possibly be causing me problems, or because my son had been on antibiotics since practically the day he was born, that was a contributing problem. I didn't know anything about the microbiome, any of these things. So if you could you break down what the total load theory is so people can understand why maybe my neighbor might not be as affected the same way as me to something in the environment?
Yeah, I love this, the framework of total load for understanding what's happening to our health in the modern era, because it so perfectly describes to me how you can have, just as you described, you have one, let's say you and your neighbor both have the same exposure to mold. One of you gets sick and the other doesn't. Well, why is that? Well, that has to do with your body's resilience and the capacity of your body to be able to withstand additional stressors given what you already have. So the concept of total load or total load theory is not mine. It comes from a couple of my mentors, Patricia Lemmer, who's written a couple of books about autism. She's been in the field of autism for a very long time, has a wonderful book called Outsmarting Autism. She first coined that term total load. It's been carried on by Dr. Martha Herbert, who's a pediatric neurologist and neuroscientist, and she talks about it in the context of autism as well. And what it basically means is, what is the complete picture of your body's resilience in the context of all the things that might be stressing your body? So an analogy is, if you think about your body as a barrel and you have, many, many stressors, things that are harmful to your body or stressful to your body, stressful to the immune system, for instance. Each one of those stressors is like a drop of water in the barrel, okay? And that those could be, exposure to electromagnetic radiation. It could be exposure to mercury amalgams, like you mentioned. It could be glyphosate in our food. It could be sugar. It could be microbes like infections, like Lyme disease. Each one of those things adds up in that barrel, right? So the barrel keeps filling and filling and filling. If you think about the modern era, living in the modern world, we are exposed to so many things that are toxic, that are stressful. I mean, an additional stressors on our body can just be emotional stress. Kids, for instance, are in pressure cookers in schools. That's also a drops in the barrel. So again, going back to this concept of total load, what happens when your barrel fills up with so many drops of water? It overflows. So when you express symptoms, whether it's learning symptoms, whether it's like perceptive behaviors that you see in autism, whether it's anxiety, whether it's eczema, whether it's asthma, that's just your body saying, okay, enough, my total load is too much. Okay, so think of your barrel just spilling over. And for every person, it's different. At what point their barrel spills over is different for a variety of reasons. The other corollary to the total load is that your barrel, the strength and size of your barrel to be able to withstand all those stressors, depends on your genetics. It depends on, what kind of microbiome did you inherit from your mother? It depends on what kinds of things you're doing to support your health. Are you getting nutritious food? Are you getting sleep? Do you have love in your life? Do you have friendships in your life? Do you get outside and get natural sunlight? Those are all things that support health and build the size and shape and strength of your barrel. So it's a ratio, right? It's a relationship between stressors and what we'll call supports. So when you have not enough supports and too many stressors, your barrel tips over and you get symptoms. So going back to the analogy of your neighbor, you both have exposure to the same mold, let's say, and you get sick and your neighbor doesn't. It's because your total load is greater than her total load, or she has more supports than you have. So that's why we see, a difference in why some kids are impacted by certain stressors and other kids aren't. So I think it's a really important concept because, we're so used to just studying one thing at a time and saying, oh, lead is dangerous. Let's get the lead out of our toys and our products. I mean, that's important, but it shouldn't just be focused on singular toxins or singular exposures. It should be looking at individual. What are their supports? What are their stressors? And how are they balanced?
I think that you just hit on one thing that I've really tried to help people understand, and I've written about it in my blogs, is the concept of bio-individuality. And that, as I spoke a little while ago, these one-size-fits-all kind of theories that are used in the medicalized model, they don't work. Even when we're talking about the current immunization schedule right now, I just feel like we need to really look at that. You can't just give every child the same thing. Like we're just talking about, you don't know what kind of toxicity the mother had, and that can be passed on to the baby. And I read Psychobiotic Revolution and talking about the increase in cesarean sections and how when you have a natural birth, the baby is supposed to be receiving that vaginal biome from the mother, which is like their first dose of good bacteria that they need to build their immune system. You know, I had two children that I was told I couldn't do anything but C-section. Now I know otherwise, and I really would have fought harder to be able to have that natural birth experience. But I really keep going back, like how it starts right from the very beginning. And I've heard you talk about the microbiome and how important that is. I've also, you know, listened to some podcasts from Karan Krishnan and just the realization of how much we are microbes. I used to be the biggest germaphobe. Let me tell you that I had pumps of antibacterial everywhere, and I thought I was doing like good. I thought that that was what I was, you know, clean and everything was sterilized, and I had no idea that I was contributing to the downfall of my health. Why do you think culturally, though, we get such kickback when we talk about like implementing some of these practices, like when we talk about, you know, eating better and eating organic, and I still feel like we just get such resistance from people. I don't know what it is. I mean, what do you get from that, from people? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a couple things at play. You know, why does a person who wants to eat healthy and feed their kids carrot sticks and celery sticks instead of goldfish, why do they get eye rolls from other moms? Or why does not putting sunscreen on your children, you know, raise an alarm bell with other parents? And I think there's a couple things. One, there's a culture that we live in that has been developing over the last couple of decades, where you eat commercial food, you buy products, like, and they're all normal. So like a rite of passage in childhood is eating goldfish crackers. A rite of passagehood in childhood is, you know, includes gummy bears and lollipops and, you know, sugar. Birthday parties are about cupcakes. So there is this cultural component. And if you do anything that, and I should say, our culture is really quite toxic to health. Like it just is. Like the junk food, the sugar, what's become very normal is just not healthy for our bodies, you know, and also culturally, we've moved indoors. We live inside. We play on devices. We watch television. You know, we don't interact with nature anymore. So if you're somebody who likes to go outdoors and interact with nature, you're kind of on the fringe of our culture, of our society, right? So there's one piece that we're fighting culture and you get pushback from people. And also the other thing is, like, if you grew up on, you know, Cheerios and SpaghettiOs and Tyson chicken pot pie or whatever, all brand name processed food, it's what your mama fed you. And when you tell somebody that something their mama fed them is wrong, that just cuts to the quick of who we are and our identity and our comfort and our, and again, that's why I go back to this is cultural. So we have to overcome that. And what we have to see is that those people who are sort of trying to do, to make healthier choices, make their own food, grow their own food in a garden, who are trying to live more naturally, it may seem like counterculture right now, but we have to keep in mind that in order for humanity to survive on this planet, that counterculture has to become the new norm. There is no way to survive as a species on this planet if we continue to live the way that we're living in 2019 with such a commercial, synthetic, plasticized, artificial, and toxic way of living. So the culture is one piece. The other piece is just, it's just capitalism, right? So all of those brands, the Tyson and the General Mills and the, you know, the Monsanto, there's all of these corporations have a profit motive. It's not in their interest to keep the population healthy. It's in their interest to keep consumers buying their products. So all of those, you know, those toxic foods are being pushed on us and marketed to us. It's you are told that it's normal to spray your lawn with Roundup. Like, of course you do that. Why? Because Monsanto is telling you so, and marketing, and giving you a really great pitch. So it's twofold. It's cultural, and then there's a profit motive. And I think that we need to see this moment in time for what it is, and we need to overcome that cultural piece, overcome the lure of the capital marketing, the capitalist marketing that's coming to us. And we have to. Otherwise, like I said, we will not be able to sustain life on this planet if we don't start making the counterculture the new mm-hmm. norm.
I feel you so much on everything that you just said. And that was really a big reason why I wanted to start this podcast, so I could create as much advocacy and awareness. And even recently, I've been just a little bit overwhelmed with everything that's been happening. And it's almost like I don't even know where to put my focus sometimes, because it's like I have even other women that come to me and they want to know, like, how can I make a difference? What can I do? And often there's just so many things. I'm like, do I focus on awareness, or do I focus on the education piece, and do I work with people one-on-one? And this can kind of just relay into your Documenting Hope project, where I feel like this is definitely something tangible that parents can do. I feel like this is such an important project, and I really would love it if you could illuminate what you guys are doing and what it is, and kind of talk on that.
Yeah, sure. So the Documenting Hope Project is rooted in the total load theory, right? So what you just described, DJ, about feeling overwhelmed about what to do, where to go, how, like all these choices that we have to make that are out there. It is, of course, it's overwhelming. And again, the idea to have to like shift the way you're living is so anathema to, you know, everything you've ever known. So how do we get people to start thinking about their own total load, and getting them to think about reducing their total load for themselves and their kids, and increasing their health supports? Well, we can educate about it, we can talk about it, but we also know that in 2019, science is king, you know, and the medical community is calling the shots when it comes to health and wellness. So while there's all these anecdotes of parents out there, for instance, who have recovered their child from every kind of chronic illness, rheumatoid arthritis or life-threatening allergies or asthma and autism. I mean, you name it. Parents have reversed these conditions partly by and significantly by addressing their child's total load and looking at them as bio-individual. That is not what the medical community is doing. And so many people are looking for guidance from the mainstream medical community. So how are we going to move the needle so the mainstream medical community starts thinking about total load? This is what drove the Documenting Hope Project. So what is the Documenting Hope Project? Essentially, it is a series of research studies designed to test and explore and investigate this concept of total load. So we developed two studies. The first study is basically just demonstrating that total load matters. So the first study is called CHIRP, and it stands for Child Health Inventory for Resilience and Prevention. And that's just what it is. It's an inventory. So we're asking parents to take an online survey. It's private. It's HIPAA compliant. The information is de-identified. So once you've taken it, we take off the names and identifiers so that we don't know when we're analyzing the data, we don't know who that data belongs to. But what the CHIRP study is doing is looking at the totality of modern living. We're asking you what your child is eating. What was their birth like? What was the neonatal period like? What was her life like before she was pregnant, when she was pregnant? What's the family health history? What kinds of exposures have you had? Do you live near a cell phone tower? Do you have Wi-Fi in your house? Does your child watch TV? Does your child play on a device? I mean, literally every question that you could think of that might impact children's health, we ask it in this survey. It takes a couple hours to complete. We've already had over 600 parents who've enrolled. But the point of this study is to collect all that information and compare it to health outcomes. So we're also asking, what's your child's diagnoses? What symptoms do they have? How severe are the symptoms? How frequent are their symptoms? And the data we're analyzing already is mind-blowing you. I mean, I'm telling you right now, it is mind-blowing, because we have been able to see that the total load, if a child's total load is greater, their health symptoms are worse. So we're already validating this concept through the CHIRP study, and we're continuing to enroll participants. We need many, many more parents to participate, because the more numbers we have, the more we can really test this concept. So that's the first, like the foundation for the Documenting Hope Project is the CHIRP study. We need to measure total load and demonstrate that it matters to health. That's step one. Step two is, so if we demonstrated that total load matters to health, well, what do we do about it? What do we do with a child who has a great total load and has autism, for instance, or has some kind of autoimmune disease? What does this mean clinically to help this child? So we've created a second study to test what happens if you reduce a child's total load and you increase their supports and treat them as a bio-individual. And that study is a longitudinal study called FLIGHT. And that stands for, this is a mouthful, stands for Facilitated Longitudinal Intensive Investigation of Genuine Health Transformation. And that's a long way of saying, what happens, again, if we take a small group of children, reduce their total load, increase their supports, and track them over time. So that study we are submitting to an institutional review board, which is an ethics and safety board, and that validates sort of the study design and make sure it's safe for participants and effectively designed. That one will hopefully begin enrolling in 2020. We've been working on it for a couple of years. It's an extremely complex study. What we're basically doing is we hope to enroll as many as 14 kids. We're going to, once they're enrolled, take baseline labs on them. So things that you can measure in blood, urine, stool, all that stuff we talked about before, microbiome, oxidative stress, cellular toxicity, structural imbalances. We're measuring that at baseline. So what does this child look like when they're sick? Now we're going to take this child who has autism, let's say, or who has alopecia, for instance, and we're going to give this child nutrient-dense, nutritious food for 18 months. We're going to remove the toxic exposures in their home. Like, let's say there's a mold exposure, or let's say there's a lead exposure. We're going to remove those exposures from their home. We're going to treat them bio-individually. So one child, for instance, has airway and breathing issues, and they're a mouth breather instead of a nasal breather. Well, we're going to help them by using a bio-individual therapy. And so what's going to happen to these kids? And that's what the FLIGHT study is investigating. The other piece of the FLIGHT study, which is, you know, something we've always wanted as part of Documenting Hope, is documenting this whole experience on film and using media to share what we're learning with everyone. Because it's one thing to do a scientific study or a series of scientific studies. You write and publish a paper, terrific, you know, and then it's going to go into some medical journal and no one's going to pay attention to it. That's not good enough for this moment in time when we have this major health crisis. So we want to document the stories of these kids as they go on this healing journey, hopefully to a place of better health. And we want to use that story to inspire people to begin to do the same work for their own families. So that's really the essence of Documenting Hope, is it's just that, is documenting that there is hope for our children. There is hope for every person who's diagnosed with a chronic health condition. You know, even if it's something that is based in, that's chromosomal or based in genes that impacts your immune function, like let's say Down syndrome. There is so much you can do by modifying an individual's environment to enhance their health. So, you know, for us, this is about showing how to optimize health by modifying lifestyle and diet and thinking about an individual bio-individually rather than one size fits all anything. Because come on, we've moved past one size fits all. That's like 19th century industrial factory approach to health. Like, that's dumb. Let's move into the 21st century and let's fix this problem that we are facing right now.
That is so amazing. I've seen a little bit of previews of stuff when I've watched your different speeches, and it's just really kind of hit me right in the mom heart watching some of the progress of these children and the amazing recoveries that are possible. And I know from my own family, we're still in the progress of healing from everything. As you know, healing really isn't a linear thing, and it takes quite a bit of time. There isn't a pill to take that's just going to make us all better. You've really got to look at everything collectively, and just like you were saying, taking that total load down, we've had to look at our exposure to Wi-Fi and our water that we're drinking and have filters on everything, even filters in our shower, because you're absorbing things from your skin, and just so many changes that we've implemented in our life that have made a significant difference, especially diet, eating all organic and GMO free. So I will put all the contact information if people want to participate in the Documenting Hope Project. Is there any age requirements, or can you tell us just what the kind of like nitty gritty details are of that?
Yeah, sure. So for the CHIRP study, which is ongoing right now, and we are continuing to enroll participants, we are looking for parents of children between the ages of 1 and 15, and you have to basically have access to a laptop or computers. And so it basically requires a parent to go on and spend a couple of hours. It ranges between 2, and the longest I've heard is about 6 hours, but it usually takes about 2 to 3 hours, depending on the severity of your child's condition. We need healthy children, parents of healthy children, and parents of children who have diagnoses and everything in between. So this is not just about, you know, telling the stories of kids who are sick. We want to know the kids who are healthy. What are they doing? So we can, you know, learn from that. And we've actually been really interested in recruiting families who live a very naturalistic lifestyle. You know, some of the Amish and Mennonite communities have been trying to ask them the questions. What are you doing? How are you living? And how are your children so healthy? So that's a really important part. So that's a CHIRP study. And people can register for that at documentinghope.com/CHIRP-study. You can also just go to documentinghope.com, and there's links right on the front page there that you can follow to the study. You have to be English speaking. We don't have it available in another language yet, and you have to be a U.S. resident. The flight study, we're not enrolling yet. We'll be enrolling in 2020. Our first location is going to be in Northern Virginia. So if people go to documentinghope.com and they sign up for our email newsletters, then they'll be alerted to when that study is enrolling. And that will be for children with chronic conditions between the ages of 2 and 16, and actually 2 and 15. So if you have a child who has a chronic health condition, I would get on our email newsletter, because we may be coming to a geography near you and you might have the opportunity. The thing I should say about the flight study is that what's really great about it is that these families don't have to pay for anything. We're going to be supplementing with organic food. We'll be providing their doctor's visits. We'll be doing all the lab tests for them. And we have some amazing partners who have donated, again, lab tests and supplements. Pure Encapsulations has donated supplements for all the participants. Genova has donated all the lab tests. I mean, so we have lots of different things that have been supplied to this project, because I think people know how important it is to demonstrate this. And it's a not-for-profit initiative. It's not like we're affiliated with some big, well-endowed university and have tons of funding for this. We've done this by people donating $5 here, $10 there, and we're continuing to raise money so we can bring more participants through the flight study.
Thank you so much. I'm so appreciative that you gave me the opportunity to be on the show so we could kind of talk about all this stuff. I recommend Beth's book, A Compromised Generation, is on my definite list of must reads. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, or?
No, I just want to say thank you for, you know, doing the work you do and keep spreading the good word, because I think the more people that are clued in and awake to what's happening, and the more we talk about it, the more we're going to shift that counterculture into mainstream. So just keep doing what you're doing. It's awesome.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Tourist, produced by PJ Harlow. All music is copyrighted to Sneaky Pete. For more information on the topic of this podcast, mold toxicity, environmental illness, Lyme disease, our toxic world, as well as other resources, education, and advocacy, you can find us at pjharlowwellness.com. If you would like to contact us, you can do so within our website and subscribe to be included in the newest wellness information. The information on this podcast is not intended as medical advice. Its intention is to share knowledge, education, and information from the personal research and experience of PJ Harlow Wellness, PJ Harlow, and Peter Harlow. The Tourist, its affiliates, guests, and the opinion of PJ Harlow Wellness, PJ Harlow, and Peter Harlow is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any health problem. Nor is it intended to replace the advice of a licensed physician or licensed healthcare professional. Always consult your physician or qualified healthcare professional on any matters regarding your health or any opinions expressed within this podcast.